This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Bourque, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. During the next hour, we're getting insights into the harried closing days of Rod Roberts' campaign for governor. He's hoping to edge out former Governor Terry Branstad and Sioux City businessman Bob Vanderplas. They're the three men hoping to be the Republicans' candidate against incumbent Democratic Governor Chet Colver in the November election. Roberts is now a state representative from Carroll in west central Iowa. On the second half of today's program, we're switching from politics to weather, talking with climatologists Harry Hilliker and Elwin Taylor. We'll be asking Hilliker and Taylor what they see ahead for summer weather. We're starting the program with politics and gubernatorial candidate Rod Roberts, right after the NPR News. Continuing with The Exchange now, I'm Dean Bourque, and I have with me Representative Rod Roberts, who is a candidate for governor of the state of Iowa. Hello.
Thank you, Dean. Good to be with you.
You've had a busy morning already. You woke up in west central Iowa in your hometown of Carroll. You were in Ames, and now you are in the Waterloo-Cedar Falls area.
Correct. It's the whistle-stop phase of the campaign as we quickly approach next Tuesday, the date of the primary election.
It's maybe the whistle stop, but I would think it takes a lot of endurance.
Yeah, it does, and a lot of good people working alongside you.
There's less than a week to go now before the primary election, as you just said. What's your campaign priority? You're on this whistle stop tour of Iowa in these final days. Is there anything left undone that you're trying to sew up in these final days, or would you just assume the election were tomorrow?
No, I believe that we're actually at a place where now it's about encouraging and challenging and activating those who support you to not only turn out to vote personally, but to do all they can at a grassroots level to talk to their family members, neighbors, friends, people at work, encourage them. Hey, I'm supporting Rod Roberts, intending to vote for him. I'd like you to do that too. So it's now about turning out the vote and at a grassroots level, encouraging people to not let up and work hard right up through the election itself.
And how do you personally turn out your segment of the vote? What do you say?
I believe that this is the year where the people have become activated and engaged in what's going on in government in a way that I've never seen in my adult life. And people are very ready to jump in and participate. And I think that people are looking for leaders who will step up and provide an entirely different kind of leadership, a different attitude of serving the people. And one of the reasons why my campaign caught fire and has been building momentum is I believe people are looking for new leadership. And being that fresh face, that new grassroots leader to have emerged this past year in our field of three candidates gives me a distinct advantage because of where the people are and what they're looking for in a candidate.
And looking for in a candidate, but also you say they're looking for change, or at least you've intimated that. So how do you – are you capitalizing on dissatisfaction, frustration among voters in order to get them out to the polls?
I think that there's a high energy level out there where people who – for many folks, they've been passive for a long time. You may have people who have indicated we show up at election time and then we tune out when it comes to politics and government in between elections, but they're no longer willing to sit along the sidelines. They want to be personally involved, and I believe this general unrest among voters, and there are a lot of people who are upset and frustrated and some angry about what's going on in government. There are so many of them that I think the potential in this primary election here in Iowa is to see a fairly significant large turnout of voters on Tuesday. And I think the voters have some surprises in mind.
Now, your opponents are Terry Branstad, former governor of Iowa for 16 years, and Bob Vanderplas, who's making a third attempt at running for governor, never held elected office before. Where do you think you said that you think that your campaign is, I don't know if you said catching fire, but mm-hmm. at least you implied mm-hmm. it's gaining momentum. Would you say that you're running third among them, or how has your polling put you?
I think that what we see going on is that this is a wide open race, and there's only been one poll that I've seen that was released just a few days ago that an out-of-state firm released. But I honestly believe, given the fact that here in Iowa, two things will be significant variables in what happens next Tuesday. One is the large number of people at the grassroots who intend to participate in this primary election. I don't think it's typical of a traditional Republican primary turnout because of who's coming. And I think, secondly, most importantly, we have a significant election law change here in Iowa. We're now same-day voter registration makes it possible for people to go in at the time they cast their vote and actually register to be a Republican if they wish to participate in the Republican primary election, do it very easily, whether they're an independent or a Democrat, and then cast that vote. And if they don't want to remain in the Republican Party, they can go ahead and change right back after they voted. And I think that also creates an entirely new paradigm here as we go into this primary election.
Make the case for me for you to get the nomination.
I believe that I am the Republican candidate best able to go into that general election campaign and take on Chet Culver. I believe I'm the Republican that can not only challenge him, but I believe I can beat Chet Culver in November. Say that for two reasons. I've served in the legislature for 10 years. 8 of those 10 years I've served in a formal leadership role. In fact, I serve as senior member of the House Republican leadership team. I am current and up to date on the issues and the challenges that we are facing in state government. I understand the legislature, and I know in a personal relationship way the key leaders within the Iowa House, the Iowa Senate, that gives me a working relationship with legislators from the get-go. I also believe that given the fact that of the 44 Republicans in the Iowa House, I have the distinction of coming from the least friendly Republican district in the caucus, meaning I have a significantly large number of independent registered voters, as well as far more Democrats than I have Republicans who have supported me, voted for me to be their state representative. And in that general election campaign with Chet Culver, I can take away his base, the independents and the Democrats. And if I am the nominee, I will lead a united Republican Party, and I will reach out and win over independents and even conservative Democrats.
But first, you've got to win the nomination before you can get to Chet Culver. And one of your opponents, Bob Vanderplaats, is basing much of his campaign, says it on his website, is he describes it as energizing the social and conservative base of the party on strident opposition to the Iowa Supreme Court decision overturning the Iowa law regarding same-sex marriage. I'm reading right from his website in saying that. He says, and I talked with him yesterday at the same time of the program, and he again repeated that this election is for the heart and soul, Mr. Vanderplaats says, of the Iowa Republican Party. Now, the other candidate, former Governor Branstad, isn't singularly focused on the heart and soul, as far as I can tell, but he includes ambitious goals for rebuilding Iowa fiscally. So with that in mind, where do you fall on that spectrum? Where... what's your aspiration against those visions, the emphasis of your campaign?
Well, it's interesting that you describe it that way because I think you see the other two candidates emphasizing two areas of great concern among conservatives, and that would be over fiscal issues here in Iowa as well as social issues. Rather than pit one against the other, I've been the candidate who has been addressing both areas of concern for conservatives. I believe that the first order of business as governor is to address the significant budget challenge that we have. I believe the budget has been mismanaged under Chet Culver, and we've got to apply fiscal discipline. I also think that equal to that important task is then to do what's necessary to see the state's economy recover and begin to grow again. So creating that friendly business climate will be important to me. And then it's about what I call respect for the people. And that's where the question of marriage comes up with me. It's been very clear throughout this past year as I've traveled the state of Iowa that the people of Iowa would like to weigh in on the question of marriage. And I believe it's a matter of respect for the people themselves to eventually allow them to vote on a proposed amendment to the state constitution. It's the right thing to do, the respectful thing to do, and I share their concern. I believe in the traditional definition of marriage. I'm also a very strong and ardent supporter of life, and people would call me a pro-life candidate. And in my 10 years in the legislature, I have demonstrated over and again that I have a strong pro-life position. I believe in the sanctity of human life. So I believe I'm the candidate that can address both areas of concern for conservatives, and I'm the candidate everyone could come behind and support and be united behind.
Are you saying that the other two, Mr. Vanderplaats, Mr. Branstad, are too focused on one aspect or the other, and you have the whole ball of wax?
And you have described something that has been of concern to me. I do think that unity within the Republican Party is absolutely essential after Tuesday's primary election. There is a very obvious division within the party among Republicans, people who support Bob Vanderplaats, who have a difficult time imagining getting behind Terry Branstad if he wins the nomination, and supporters of the former governor who have concern about Bob Vanderplaats, some who will express it if Mr. Vanderplaats wins the nomination. Don't know if I'm going to be actively involved and willing to support and get behind him. We have that issue within the party. And I'm concerned that if we're divided coming out of Tuesday's primary election, we all of a sudden find ourselves at a huge disadvantage in taking on Chet Colver. We've got to be together, and all Republicans have to unite behind our nominee. I think with me, as you described it, you get the whole ball of wax.
Do you think when it really comes to, if Mr. Vanderplaats or Mr. Branstad wins the nomination, do you think that there's going to be a divided Republican Party?
The potential is there based on what I observe and what I listen to. People have very strong emotions right now about government and about the state of not only government or politics in general, but just in terms of the culture, where we are with key social issues. And to those people whom those things matter greatly, there is no compromise. It's a very black and white kind of reality, and that's why whether it's these folks who support Bob Vanderplaats or those who are less concerned about those social issues but very concerned about fiscal matters or the economy, who have strong reservation about Bob Vanderplaats being able to effectively lead, if we come out of this with people having strong feelings opposed to whoever wins, we're in a disadvantage situation with Chet Colver.
And that gets me to another aspect. You've expressed frustration, I think I could say it that way, at the way the campaign has evolved and some of the sniping between the other two candidates. You've tried to stay above that. How, though, if you've tried to stay out of a fracas, do you expect the campaign in the general election against Chet Colver?
I think that the people of Iowa are evaluating Chet Colver and are already concluding that he has not provided effective leadership for the state of Iowa. I think ultimately the contest with him is about who is best able to lead the state as governor, and it will be a campaign about issues and ideas. And I believe that people are very open to a conservative Republican candidate in this particular election. I can be that candidate.
We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back talking with Representative Rod Roberts, candidate for governor of Iowa. He wants the nomination by the Republican Party. We'll be talking with Representative Roberts right after a short break. The exchange continues. Dean Borg now with Representative Rod Roberts, candidate for the Republican nomination for governor of Iowa. I want to go back to what we were talking about just before the break and finish it up there, because what I asked was, you have really taken the, become known as the nice guy in this campaign, not throwing charges back and forth and trying to stay above the fray. In fact, I can remember in a debate, you maybe... you didn't know you did, but you rolled your eyes as the other two candidates were going at each other. But I think there's some concern as to whether or not in a struggle in the general election campaign as to if you're involved in a very down and dirty campaign and it gets that way, can you hold your own?
Yes, absolutely. I believe that as a Republican, particularly in this primary race, it's important that the candidates, I believe, treat each other respectfully. We can talk about issues. We can even point out records, if you will, but do it in a respectful way. And I think there have been moments where People have seen the other two candidates, and it gets to a level where people just shake their head from side to side going, this is what we are unhappy about and disgusted about in politics. Everything that I talk about out on the campaign trail in terms of where I'm focused and what I'm talking about is about Chet Colver, his failed leadership. And I think that message will resonate with Iowans as I go into the general election campaign and point out those areas where I believe he has failed the people of Iowa. Now, if he's going to get down and dirty, then that's what he'll do. But I think the people are ready to respond to that, and I think they will reject that on his part.
Mr. Vonderplas highlights the fact that he's never been elected to government office. You're an incumbent, having served 10 years, I believe it is, as a state representative from Carroll County. This is a seemingly anti-incumbent year, and how do you counter that?
The perception a lot of people have, though, is that you have been a state representative serving in the legislature, but you are now a candidate running for governor, and there is a distinction made, and most people recognize those 10 years of serving in the legislature as a citizen legislator, part-time legislator, provides you a level of experience that will be an asset to you as governor. So it's been more of an asset than it has been, you know, a liability or a detriment. And even though perhaps Bob Vanderplas hasn't been elected to office in the past, it's not for a lack of trying. In fact, of the three candidates running, he's the only candidate whom Governor Colver has defeated in a previous election when he was on the 2006 ballot.
You're running this campaign, I think, admittedly, on a shoestring. You probably have the least money of among the three. But if you win the nomination, will you have enough to go up against the treasury, campaign treasury, that Chet Colver has?
Yes, I've never been concerned with campaign funding after I win the nomination, because I believe support will be there and we will generate the funds necessary to compete head-to-head with Chet Colver. And he may have a large sum of money already bankrolled for that general election campaign, but when I win on Tuesday, I believe that people will respond and they will be generous, and those contributions will come in as they have already from the grassroots. And it's been important to me to make sure people understand I'm a grassroots candidate. I don't have a special interest group or groups who approached me, asked me to be their candidate, and I'm certainly not a political party establishment candidate. And I think that's an asset and a help to me.
I want to ask your opinion here on the campaign against former Governor Branstad conducted by an organization headed by former Iowa Democratic Chair Rob Tully. And those ads by the tax-exempt organization are using TV ads, as you know, and direct mail advertising. But the contributors to that campaign won't be known until July at the earliest. Does that bother you?
Yes, it does. I believe that we ought to provide greater openness and accountability on the part of those who participate in the political process, just like we should in government, so that the citizens can see who is involved, who's participating, and specifically in this case, who's contributing the money. Because it's obvious to me someone is spending an awful lot of money in this campaign effort against Terry Branstad, and I think Iowans would like to know who's contributing this and how much money are they contributing.
Why do you think it's being targeted against former Governor Branstad?
You know, I just believe that these individuals probably perceive that Governor Branstad, on the surface, has, you know, the campaign resources. If he wins the nomination on Tuesday, that he will have a formidable campaign to run. But I also think they're spelling out and laying it out very clearly. This is where we intend to go. If he's the nominee, this is the campaign he can expect, and we're going to lay out his record from the past.
Mm-hmm. You're a social conservative. What's your vision for the gambling industry in Iowa?
I am no proponent of expanding legalized gambling in Iowa. However, I have a mature attitude, I think, about this industry that now says we have completely saturated the state with as many opportunities for people to gamble, whether it be visiting a casino or participating in other forms of gambling, to where I believe we now have maximized all those possibilities, and the responsibility of those in state government, particularly the governor, is to provide regulation and management of this industry. Until the people of Iowa say to their elected officials somewhere in the future, we've had enough of this or there's too much, begin repealing or taking some of it away, I don't believe we're going to see much more expansion here in Iowa. We've reached that point where everything possible is now in place, and the job of the governor is to provide regulation and management oversight, and that's what I would do.
In what department of state government would you see making the greatest changes? The Department of Social Services, Department of Education, Economic Development. I'm just naming a few there. Mm-hmm. You choose maybe one that I haven't.
I believe that a lot of people I listen to across the state of Iowa who are involved in business believe that the Department of Natural Resources is a department that needs to be thoroughly reviewed and evaluated in terms of the kind of oversight and involvement in business here in Iowa. Almost what I hear from business owners is that it's almost become an adversarial relationship and that they don't understand why a department like that in state government views its role as almost being adversarial to business.
That's the department headed by Rich Leopold now?
Correct. Yep. That would be an instance. And I think the Department of Human Services, as you highlight, I believe that that department as well needs a thorough review and evaluation as to the programs and services it provides. I think that we need to have individuals in leadership positions within our departments that have a clearer sense of what it is to provide efficiency and streamline those departments and make those departments as taxpayer conscious and efficient as we possibly can as they deliver their respective services.
I'd like to go back to your comments on the DNR. What changes would you make there?
I think you start with an attitude or a mindset, and that's what I'm speaking about when I reference these business owners, where anymore, when people come in to do an inspection or to provide some kind of oversight, it's almost like we anticipate something bad is going to happen. They're going to drop a bag of hammers on us. And I think it has more to do with an attitude of why is it that we are involved with business in the first place. And I think business people are willing to have regulation. But what I've concluded from my listening across the state, it's almost gotten to the point where we've crossed the line and it now is overbearing, and it is an impediment to business.
And you're citing business there. Are you including agriculture business and the siting of large livestock operations?
I think even within the livestock industry, within agriculture, I hear from a lot of people that we try to work with the Department of Natural Resources. We do the best we can to try to accommodate and live within the rules and regulations. But even with livestock producers, you find frustration. I have a lot of independent cattle producers back in West Central Iowa, and they have frustration about trying to accommodate and come into compliance with rules and regulations and then be assured that they're in compliance for a set period of time where they know what their business plan can be, but they never get a definite answer and an answer that says you're in compliance for a set period of time, you're okay with your business plan.
We're going to wind up here in just a second. One last question. If you aren't successful, you say you're going to be, in winning the Republican nomination next Tuesday, will you keep on campaigning?
Obviously, any candidate worth their salt believes they're going to win, and that's how you work this. But, you know, no matter what the outcome is next Tuesday, I will have run a credible campaign. I will have established myself across the state as someone who I think personifies the kind of leadership Iowans are looking for in elected office.
And that means you might be campaigning then for whoever would win the nomination.
I will support the nominee.
Good. Mr. Roberts, thanks so much for being our guest today on The Exchange.
Thank you very much.
We'll continue with The Exchange in just a moment from Iowa Public Radio. And I'm Dean Borg, continuing The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. We're turning to weather now, talking with Harry Hilliker, state climatologist, speaking from his office in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Harry.
Good afternoon, Dean.
And with Elwin Taylor, who's at our Iowa Public Radio Ames studio. Elwin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dean. Hello, Harry.
Gentlemen, you study weather history and apply those data to current trends. Given that, what trends are you currently observing that can help predict what's ahead during this crucial crop season the next few months? Go first of all, you do, Elwin.
Well, we watch this, several things, Dean, that has to do with the immediate crop season. Maybe Harry will be able to give us a little better outlook on the trends that go over a 20-year period as well. But the things that we're watching this season, a lot of people are concerned that we are switching from an El Nino condition, which we had at January and February, and now it's been switching rapidly to neutral, and appears that before this month is out, we will be in a La Nina situation. And that is a risk changer as far as crop production goes. It doesn't bring a definitive change in the weather, but it does bring a change to more days when we have oppressively high temperatures, if we look at the statistics.
Well, would you say, Elwin, are you saying that that's risky if we are switching to El Nino, that it's a more risky situation for Iowa farmers?
So switching from El Nino to La Nina.
La Nina, yes.
And that increases our risk because of a greater occurrence of high temperature in the summers. We have really not seen high temperatures like we used to, you might say, during this past few years during the summertime. High temperature greatly increases the crop demand for water, and so a lot of times people say, well, it resulted in a drought because the plants could not get enough water, and that is, of course, true, but if the temperature had been lower, the plants wouldn't have needed so much water. So we're watching that switch from the El Nino, which almost always results in an above trend line yield, or at least 70% of the time it is, to La Nina, that 70% of the time the crop yields are below the average or the trend line.
Harry Hilliker, is that how you see it too? Are we moving toward La Nina and a very risky possibility?
Yeah, it looks basically similar thinking, I guess. And although the transition from El Nino to La Nina, not necessarily a whole lot different than if we just go to neutral as far as what the historical statistics say. Almost always El Nino does start to fade away this time of the year. This time, though, it has been very, very rapid demise and quite unusual to see it go quite so quickly. But certainly the odds are pretty strong just in years with start with El Nino, such as 2010 did. For our temperatures during the summer months to average warmer than usual. In fact, it works out to about 80-85% of the time that would have a warmer than normal summer in years that begin with an El Nino in place. That's regardless of whether El Nino persists or not. And the fact that it's going towards La Nina appears to be probably kind of strengthens those odds a little bit. So a warmer than normal summer, not a guarantee, but certainly pretty good odds in that direction, and that would serve, as Ellen is saying, quite a contrast to what we've been seeing, actually recent decades for the most part, but specifically last year and the year before, we had very, very little in the way of really high temperatures during the summer months.
Does that also carry, Harry, the prospect of not only hot weather, but lower than normal rainfall?
On the rainfall end of things, it's just a slight tendency to be drier than usual. In fact, it's not much better than a coin flip as far as historical odds go, looking at other years where this transition from El Nino to La Nina took place. The worrisome part is we do have some examples where that contrast was very bad, I guess you'd say, in Iowa. 1988 actually is one of those years where we start off the year with El Nino, and we're well into La Nina by the time the growing season got going, or the summer got going that year. That'd be, you know, the very extreme example of what could happen. Hopefully won't be in that bad a shape this time. And certainly we've had a much more favorable spring this year than what 1988 brought us, which was already very dry that year compared to this year. We've had more typical rainfall.
Or Elwin, since we've had such a good spring, people got their crops in a little bit ahead of average. I would guess that that's true. Is that put us in better stead, though, with the corn crop and the soybean crop in the event that the La Nina conditions do promote heat and drier than normal weather?
Well, Dean, it would appear that it would, and of course that isn't always a guarantee either. And the Statistical Reporting Service pointed out that for the Corn Belt, this is really the earliest planting of corn overall that they have since they've been keeping accurate records on this sort of thing. Of course, being planted so early, some people got hit by some frost, and in some places that did significant damage. In other places, it just frightened them, but didn't really hurt the crop. So we think that, yes, maybe being in a little bit early will be a help. Now, Harry was mentioning 1988. Being in early was not a help that year, because the earlier planted things were up and very, very susceptible to the early heat wave. We had already had some days in Iowa that were at 100 degrees, maybe a place or two that had already broken the 100 number by this date. So when people say, will we repeat 1988, no, we will not repeat that, at least for weather pattern. It could happen for crop yield, I suppose. More like the second worst year since the 50s, which was 1983, where the El Nino event of the winter also ended very rapidly, but it ended in May and June, which is what it's doing right now. So more people are worried at the moment about a repeat of 1983, which was a disaster overall across the Corn Belt to both corn and, in many places, soybean yields, in that the really harsh weather was in late July and early August, July being the most important month, or when the corn is most susceptible to dry, hot weather, and August being the more important month for the soybean.
Gentlemen, we're going to ask our listeners if they have some questions for you, and the number for them to call, and we may be able to take a few calls, is 866-780-9100. Again, 866-780-9100. While they're dialing in, this may be a poor way to ask a question of two weather scientists, but until last Tuesday night, when the Mount Air area of southwest Iowa experienced tornadic winds, people were remarking about the storm-free spring. Was that just a coincidence, Elwin, or is there a weather phenomena causing a relatively pleasant spring?
Well, of course, there was a synoptic, we call it, or a wide area event going on. It didn't seem to have any real reason that I'm aware of. Maybe Harry's aware of something. But I think it was more just incidental that spring was pleasant at the time that it was. And people asked me if we were going to get by without any severe storms. And my answer was I couldn't see any reason to think that they were gone for this year. And so almost as soon as I was saying that, then we had 80-mile-per-hour winds and heavy rain and Lamoni, and then, of course, up toward Mount Air with the damage that they had.
What do you think, Harry?
Well, yeah, I think it's more or less, you might say, just luck, I guess you'd say. When you get the ingredients all together at the right time to get severe weather, we've just been lucky in Iowa so far, until June 1st, obviously. But it was certainly a very, very late start to our tornado season. Latest start since 1978, in fact, to be specific on that. And also just a very long period without tornadoes, period. We had a kind of early end to last year's tornado season. August 19th was the last date of tornadoes in the state, so we had a really nice long period without worrying about tornadoes for a change. But we're certainly right in the heart of tornado season right now. The fact that the first half of the season or so was so very quiet really doesn't tell us much as far as what to expect down the road, although
isn't spring
hotter, really hot summer weather typically is not all that favorable for tornadoes. That typically have a lot of what I call capping conditions, where thunderstorm development could be a bit suppressed, but all kinds of things are possible. You never know. 1988, the year we already talked about, they had the major drought, was actually a very quiet year for severe weather, except one day where everything came together just the right way, and that was actually happening to be Mother's Day that year, but kind of made the season in just one afternoon. We had a lot of severe weather that made up for a lot of quiet weather elsewhere in the season. So we can never let down our guard, unfortunately, in Iowa with when it comes to tornadoes and severe weather.
But you did answer my question that I was going to ask, and that is, it seems that the spring is a more of a tornado-type weather period than is the summer, and you've said, yes, that is true, but you can expect them anytime.
Yeah, just about any time. May and June are by far our biggest months as far as tornado occurrences. They account for over half the historical occurrences, with June being slightly more favorable than May historically. But, yeah, the numbers do go down considerably by the time we get to July and considerably more through the rest of the year. But prime time, though, is right now.
We're talking with Harry Hilliker. You've just heard him, state climatologist, speaking from Des Moines. Elwin Taylor is in our Iowa Public Radio Ames studio. He's Iowa State University Extension climatologist. Gentlemen, one of the things that is occupying the news right now is the petroleum contamination in the Gulf waters off the shores of Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and maybe even Florida. Will that at all influence our weather? Elwin?
I've been looking at that a bit and consulting with some people that work a great deal with the amount of moisture in the air. With more than 80% of our precipitation originating with moisture leaving the Gulf of Mexico and being carried up the plains, then we would be concerned, are we getting all of the regular amount of moisture? Well, we seem to have the flow of southerly air. Is the air carrying the moisture in the air? And that's been the concern with the petroleum. And they say, well, if there's a big oil slick down there in the Gulf, will we get the high humidity of the air coming here with all of the moisture it should carry? And that is good rational thinking. So I have talked to people that are studying this oil slick, and they say it's not a slick. There are spots that they have oil slick, but it's just spotty. And not a uniform oil cover. They don't think it will have a measurable effect on the amount of moisture, precipitable moisture, we call it in meteorology, that is carried by the air mass moving from the Gulf into the Midwest. In other words, no direct effect on our precipitation.
And Harry, does most of our precipitation then come from that area of the Gulf or over in the Texas area?
Well, obviously it varies somewhat from year to year and event to event, but for the most part, more of the western Gulf, you know, off the Texas coast, and it would be more the direct source, more frequently is the direct source for us. And but it's still an interesting question to ponder. For example, or some of our remote rain gauges that are locations hard to get to, it's common practice to put a little bit of oil in the gauges to prevent evaporation, so you go read them, say, a week later, 2 weeks later, without losing how much rainfall had occurred, because that oil film floats to the top of the water and inhibits evaporation beneath it. And so the fact that you got all this oil in the Gulf, even on a kind of local basis, you know, certainly, mm-hmm. you know, causes some, you to ponder what the results may be. If there's any indication, though, you know, we did have the last week of May, you know, some very warm, very humid air in Iowa, really extremely humid air for late May. And if that was any indication, you know, at least at that point, we wouldn't seem to have been having much much impact. But it's one of those things really hard to know what's going on.
If you have a question for Elwin Taylor or Harry Hilliker, the number to call is 866-780-9100. Is Iowa, Harry, a bit behind right now normal rainfall, say, in the last 30 days?
Yeah, certainly in the very recent time period. Year-to-date, we're actually just barely ahead of normal pace. The month of May, in fact, the spring as a whole, almost exactly normal, but the distribution, as always, is rather irregular. Southeast Iowa is very, very wet right now, particularly the far southeast, say Fairfield, Wapello area southward, extremely wet right now and has been for some time. Other areas of the state, especially the northwest, Sioux City area, up towards Spencer and Estherville, quite dry, not super dry just yet, but have turned pretty dry in the last month or two. But overall, rainfall this year has been fairly average. Which is actually a bit drier than what we've seen in recent years. Even though we had normal rainfall this spring, that's actually made our driest spring in 5 years. In other words, we had four consecutive wetter-than-normal springs prior to this year.
Elwin, I know we went into this spring just saturated in the subsoil moisture. Is that pretty much still the case?
Yes, we still have ample water in the subsoil. Of course, plants have to be able to get that water, so they have to be well established and have their roots down into that moisture for these areas, such as in the northwestern portion of the state, where the top 6 or 7 inches of soil has become fairly dry in some places. And it has been known that in a year when we did have ample moisture, we could still have the crop not get enough moisture because its roots don't keep up with to the depth where that moisture is. That happened back in 2002, I believe it was, where the temperatures were so cool the plant roots didn't grow well, and so they lost contact with their water, and we ended up with some drought stress in the crop, even though the tiles were still running to get rid of excess water from the deeper subsoil areas.
Elwin, Harry, we're running a little bit short of time here, and Joyce is calling from Tama County. Let's take a call from her. Joyce?
I was wondering if there's any six-week effect that might affect our weather for the summer and fall, like from the Gulf or from up by Alaska. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Elwin?
This six-week effect is one that climatologists have debated for quite a while because it does not show up in our long-term records. But what we have noticed is that once we get a six-week cycle going, it tends to go that year just because I think it's a normal resonance type thing. And are we seeing that type of thing? We could be. In fact, right now, we're very paying very close attention to what's going on in the Gulf of Alaska. When a low pressure begins to persist there, the average persistence time is 4 to 8 weeks, 6 weeks being the average, and that indeed is what has happened. It happened in 89 and ended almost 6 weeks to the day, but a lot of people thought we were in for another 1988, and then that switched to the opposite phase for 6 weeks and went back and forth. So yes, we have some indication we could be going into one of these patterns where we have rather warm weather for 3 weeks or so, and then rather cool, and then warm, and then cool. We shall see, though. It certainly hasn't established to this point. And yes, we are watching a low pressure that entered the Gulf of Alaska in the past 2 days. If it stays three without moving significantly, it often stays for weeks. When there is a low pressure there, it does tend to put a stop to precipitation of a significant amount in most of Iowa.
So we could be heading into a dry spell. Randy is on the line from Mason City, and I think he has a quick one here, and then we can get that in before we have to close. Randy?
Oh, thank you. Hey, Elwin, I really appreciate all the information you've put out over the years. And could you give us your website we could go to? I'm going to send you an email for some information about the weather in the Rocky Mountains at the end of September. I appreciate it, okay? I really thank you for all you've done.
Well, thank you very much, Randy. And anyone that would like to send me an email, it's S.E. Taylor, written as one word, like Southeast Taylor, S-E-T-A-Y-L-O-R, at I-A-S-T-A-T-E, means Iowa State, iastate.edu. I will answer that. I'm trying to get a lot of comments on Twitter, twitter.com/Elwin Taylor, written as one word, E-L-W-Y-N-N-T-A-Y-L-O-R.
And Harry, just a quick question to you. Is our weather at all being influenced by the volcanic ash in the air from the eruption in Iceland that caused so much disruption of air traffic during April in Europe?
Well, first guess is probably not much of one. And generally, as far as climate impacts, we look for eruptions that put ash well up into the stratosphere. And the Icelandic volcano, so far as I know, is putting it a little bit lower, which is why it's causing all the trouble with air traffic 30,000, 40,000 feet up. We need to get up a little bit higher than that for the ash to remain suspended in the atmosphere, you know, for months at a time, and therefore, you know, block a lot of sunlight. But I think this one's low enough in the atmosphere that much of the ash is settling fairly quickly, and therefore probably not having a huge impact on the weather. Although there is a lot of other volcanoes, oddly enough, active right at the moment. One in Ecuador in particular is doing some rather major eruptions recently that yeah, I'd keep an eye on that one at the moment.
Well, are you saying, Harry, that that has the potential to affect Iowa's weather?
Possibly. Yeah, it's one of those things. That would be one thing that would, if there was a major eruption, to help lower temperatures and maybe reduce the, you know, the odds of having a hotter than normal summer for us.
And just a quick one, Elwin, what's your biggest weather concern right now in the next few months?
Our major concern will be this switch to La Nina if it results in a warmer than usual summer. The National Weather Service, by the way, is still forecasting that the summer will be on the cool side of usual, as it has been the past two summers.
Mm-hmm. Good. Gentlemen, thanks so much. We've been talking with Harry Hilliker, the state climatologist, speaking from his office in Des Moines. Elwin Taylor, speaking from the Iowa Public Radio station and studio in Ames, is Iowa State University Extension climatologist. Elwin and Harry, thanks so much for your comments.
You're welcome.
Good to be with you.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance from Christina Sarnelli and Barb Reed today. Technical support from Phil Moss at our Cedar Falls studio, Dennis Reese in Iowa City. And we always welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us anytime by email. The address is theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Theme music, you're listening to it right now, it's being performed by Dan Knight. And The Exchange is produced by Iowa Public Radio News.